Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Magical Learning Podcast this week. Over December and January, we're doing an exciting special edition podcast to celebrate Danette's first book, The Adaptable Leader. If you're on Spotify, you can see the cover of it right now. I'm holding it up. We are doing a special podcast where Danette's talking to people who have been adaptable leaders in various different spaces. There's some people you'll remember from the Magical Learning Podcast, and there'll be some new faces as well and some old friends. This is a really great podcast, and it was recorded before the book was actually finalized. So there's bits of the podcast in the book, but we highly recommend you go check out that book as well. We'll be back with regular Magical Learning podcasts in mid-January. But until then, this is an amazing little bonus podcast project we've set up for you. So as always, enjoy and have a magical week. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Adapt with Danette FM podcast. I'm Jez FM, doing the podcast producing, and of course, this is a companion podcast to the amazing book, The Adaptable Leader by Danette Fenton-Menzies. And of course, with me right now is Danette Fenton-Menzies. So, Danette, how are you going?
Yeah, really good, Jez. Listeners, if you hear a little bit of weird noises in the background, that is the chickens and the guinea fowls telling me that it's nearly time for dinner. So apologize in advance if you hear weird noises. But no, having a great week, Jess. Thank you.
They're amazing guests on the Adapt with Danette FM podcast. And look, you can go to our Magical Learning socials to maybe see a picture of them. Magical yes. Learning. I also do the podcast production there as well. And Danette's on that podcast as well. So there's a lot of extra content for you to go check out there. So today we're going to be talking with Kirsten Peterson, PhD, aka KP. We're going to be calling Kirsten KP for the rest of this podcast. We're going to be talking about an awesome topic, which is how listening and rest creates Olympic level performance. So do you want to maybe break down maybe some initial thoughts you had or how you found the conversation with KP?
Yeah, so for those who've not been introduced to KP before, she trained for many years Olympic level athletes and has written a book about when grit's not enough, so how we can push ourselves too much. And I love this conversation. We went through the conversation and then we ended up having an additional conversation about listening and rest. And we were talking about how it's really easy to keep doing as leaders because, you know, the world and society rewards doing, but actually pausing and listening to yourself can actually tell you whether the direction you're heading is actually a good one or not, whether it's sustainable or not. So it was an awesome conversation, and I hope everyone enjoys it as much as I did.
Absolutely. And if you're not sure about, you know, how does rest and pausing sort of go, a great example that I'm going to tee you up with this conversation is when the Olympics were moved one year, some coaches approached it as if the Olympics was happening in the next 2 weeks to keep everybody locked in, and other ones introduced more rest to sort of extend the skills of the athletes. So I encourage people to see which one did better.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's all I'm going to say for this conversation. We'll throw you right to it. Have a listen and enjoy.
Welcome, everyone. And today I'm super excited to invite a good friend of mine, Kirsten Peterson, who I like to call KP, who has written a magnificent book. And I'm just going to show you this, When Grit Is Not Enough. And I thought, given we've been talking about adaptability and learning from failure and things like that, that it would be great to hear a little bit about what KP does and also talk a little bit about adaptability. So, KP, welcome first, and I'd love for you to introduce yourself and tell people a little bit about your background, who you are, and also about your book.
Wow, okay. I was born, no, I'm kidding, I won't start back that far. First of all, I just want to thank you, Danette. It's been a delight to, we kind of stumbled upon each other in Canberra a few years ago, and it's blossomed into a friendship that keeps giving. And so it's my delight to be here. So I come from a background, I'll go back farther than you probably want me to, but as a young female athlete at a time when there weren't any sports, and That really formed my personality, this like kind of the understanding and the love of sport as a way to maybe cope with life. And I loved the sense of achievement and competition it brought to me, but it was at a time when women didn't do a lot of that. And so it was a weird thing for me. So I'll put a stop on that for a moment and then say I found psychology in college. And when I found out there was a field called sport psychology, where I should also mention that I was a softball pitcher in college who forgot how to throw strikes. They now call that the yips. And so I didn't have anybody who could help me through that. And so I also thought sports psychology was a neat thing to help athletes who might be struggling. But marriage of two perfect things in my life, I was off and running, spent over 20 years in the Olympic world of sports psychology, which I, you know, wouldn't trade for anything. But it informed me in ways that were good and bad about the what underpins true high performance. You know, people look at the Olympic world and think, of course, that's all high performance, but it's amazing to me how resilient people are, that despite some of the things that we were doing in high performance back then and to this day, that people are still able to perform well. But I've now learned the difference between high performance that can be done once. Perhaps we could use the word adaptability, a lack of ability to adapt to different circumstances, but high performance that also suffers at the hands of people who don't understand how to bring it out in others. And what I mean by that are, I literally worked for coaches who said things like, I break them, you fix them, KP, oh, sports psychologist. Meaning almost like that was seen as how you did things. And so it wasn't though until I kind of came out of the sport world and had some perspective on it, because when you're working in it and you're also beholden to people who are paying your pay or asking you to work for people like this, you're in a kind of a place. But now that I'm on my own, I have made it my business to understand, you know, we know so much more about how the brain and mind work, but even back when I was in graduate school, I've delved into the kind of Eastern philosophies and mindfulness and meditation, and Buddhists have it going on when it comes to performance, I will just say, to kind of weave together this idea of high performance that shouldn't hurt people and that we can actually make things happen. And so it feels like it really blends well with your concept of adaptable leadership, because I could cheerfully say that leadership that doesn't adapt and doesn't pivot and isn't agile is going to be the kind of leadership that at least makes performance harder, if not breaks people. So I think we're on the same page there. Does that give you a good starting block there?
It's a great starting block, and so agree, because I've recently been dealing with a couple of people who were talking about the huge hours they're working and they don't expect it of the team, but they're the leader. And then they'll question those that are leaving early. And it's like, you know what? That working harder is not necessarily going to make you adaptable. It's not going to make you sustainable. And you're one of the things I loved about your book is the fact that it was really flipping that whole work harder, push harder, break people on its head. To actually go, there's a better way, and it's a kinder and a softer way that gets really great results. So I'd love for you to share sort of why you decided to write this book and some of the key insights, and maybe how you reached out to Angela Duxworth as well.
Yeah, that's, oh God. Well, I'll start there, because that kind of, that shaped some, well, the genesis of the book, I'll start here, in time was when COVID hit the elite sport world in particular, but the world in general, you did see people and institutions break apart in ways that we had not experienced before, because we haven't had something as massive as a global pandemic. But focusing on elite sport, what was interesting to me is that in this period of uncertainty, which sport doesn't take to at all, because it's all about periodized training and knowing your competition schedule, if one, if not 4 years out, so you can make plans and have really straight and level runways. Because you know when the Olympics are, right? Except in 2020, they weren't. But anyway, the genesis for the book was really seeing people in the elite sport world who I would have thought would have weathered the crisis really well, actually doing what I, you know, come to kind of see as over gritting, like doubling down on what used to work. And in one unfortunate case, a national team coach who did that, right after the Olympics in 2020 were postponed a year, but kept training his athletes as if they were 2 weeks out from a games when they were a year and 2 weeks out, and literally shed a quarter of the national team he was training because these people were just like, it's not worth it to me. Yeah, I can stay a year, but not under these conditions. And, you know, the unfortunate consequences of that versus other coaches I saw who were quickly able to pivot out of performance into mental health and well-being or whatever it took to help their athletes in that moment. So all that being said, there's like, what a great learning petri dish this otherwise horrible tragedy of a pandemic was. So I just, hit the ground running, writing this book, talking about grit as if I knew what it was, having not read Angela Duckworth's seminal work of the same title, because at the time when she came out with her book, which was about this combination of passion and perseverance that we might get into later, the ingredients she found that helped people kind of stick to tough goals, when she came out with it, it became quickly a word that coaches in sport, I would say, weaponized as another way to tell athletes, you know, you're not gritty enough, or you need more grit and go get yourself some, as opposed to really understanding the concept. So I had kind of kept a real wide berth of yet another word that did that kind of thing. So I'm writing this book, I'm using the word grit freely, thinking, shit, what if Angela, like, she said something to what I'm writing and I don't even know, or what if I'm not even capturing her concept correctly? So after like, I don't know how many months, I finally read her book, like with a sigh, you're like, oh fuck, here I go. Sorry, second swear word not many times. Anyway, 422 pages or whatever it was, and it was a great read. I don't know if you've read it, Danette, but very engaging, compelling, tells a great story. I was secretly thinking that at the end, I hadn't seen anything about over-gritting, which was kind of my thing. So after the book was done, I had so many questions. And so I looked Angela up online and found a way to contact her and just said, asked her my questions about, what do you think about over-gritting? Can you overuse this thing? And within an hour, she had gotten back to me. I know, like, who does that? I was like kind of, writing the Dalai Lama or something. Having
so awesome, isn't it?
I was, because here I am trying to mask the fact that I'd only just read her book. You know, I'm like a longtime fan, all of 72 hours, you know. And she agreed to be interviewed, and I was able to bring some of her insights into the book. But I was most secretly relieved that she not only didn't have a lot to say about the concept of how you overuse it, she really wasn't interested because her passion was on the front end of helping kids find grit, and which I think is a really worthwhile goal in and of itself, but you can only spend time at one end of that spectrum, and she was cheerfully allowing me to rent out my space on the far end. So it all worked out well for me. Thank God. And my book was better for it. So I don't know if that's the Angela Duckworth story. I can go out, but direct me more to help me get back on track.
And I love that story when I read it in your book. So I thought, you know what? And, you know, even that goes to adaptability, because you could have gone, just got to ignore it. But you reached out and look what happened. So that's pretty awesome. So I might ask a question or two and then we'll come back to the book and sort of the grit and adaptability.
Sure.
So I'm curious for you yourself, given you've sort of been in the high performance space for a long time, what are some things that you would do that would actually help you adapt?
That's really an ironic question, because I was gratified to see when I took Angela Duckworth's grit scale that I was like in the 95th percentile, you know, like I'm gritty. So ironically, I'm sometimes horrible at adapting because I am an over-gritter myself. And, you know, we call that the irony of expertise, that I can write a book on how not to do it, but don't don't look at my life for an example of that. But when I think about when I am at my, when I am my wisest self, I guess I would say, it's the ability to like pause. And that, you know, that sounds so stupidly simple. Like, of course we can all do that, but how many times do we just keep going? Either because we always have, or because it's always worked, and that's kind of the premise of the book. But for myself, when I can, the phrase I like to use and I use in the book is like, right now it's like this, but to even recognize what right now means. So you, I adapt much better when I am really, when I'm aware of what's happening to know what's needed. And I think we don't stop fast enough or long enough or thoughtfully enough to even recognize that. And it's easy, but it's profound, because you can think, I need to drink water, but maybe I really need a hug. You know, like it, the need goes, you just can unpeel an onion when you realize what is needed. And to adapt to those needs, it's only when you know what they are. And so again, I it's funny, I just feel like on one level, it's, somebody said, you know, like meditation, which is a practice that is part of this, it's simple, but it's not easy. And I think the pause to allow adaptability to happen sounds simple, but it sure ain't easy. So I'll leave it there and see what you want to riff off that.
I totally love that, and totally true, because we're in a society that is about doing.
Yeah.
And really to pause, you've got to be, and you've got to be open to the fact that I might think I want water, but if I sit with that for even 30 seconds, I might find that actually that's not really what I want.
Or it might be what I need. Yeah, I love that distinction between, well, yeah, I need, always can drink water, you know, hydration's great, but what's really happening, you know? Yeah, so I love that distinction.
Nice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, for leaders, getting off that treadmill of doing and thinking that that's, one, high performance, two, it's sustainable, mm-hmm. when, you know, the brain science really shows that things like meditation, mindfulness, which people go, I'm too busy just to do. It's like, you're too busy not to do those. You need to slow it down and pause, because, as you said, that's where your wisdom sits. But I love that, because that helps us be adaptable. And I can see you just wanted to say something there.
So I know, because it's so profound. Because even, like, what came to mind as you were talking was how many leaders I hear say, I just need time to think. And like, think that it's like blocking time out in the schedule to do what exactly? So I'm gonna think now. And it's not even that, you know what I mean? Like it's really valuing that idea. And the other thought I have is the, like, to be able to just be. But we are conditioned to run screaming from the party that goes on between our ears, that we are profoundly, often profoundly uncomfortable with what our minds are doing, even as they are doing it. And it's like turning inward and seeing that there's a frickin' rave going on with people spilling beer all over the place. And like, I don't want to spend any time there. And yet the only way the pauses pay off is when we learn how to do that. So, you know, it goes to a place of recognizing why, like, okay, I'm gonna think. All right, put my thinking cap on, and what am I thinking about? You know what I mean? Like, you, and so there's something really interesting there that we could go on all day about, I'm sure, but let's not.
I was actually quite excited about that. I was quite enjoying that. And it is such a, yeah, it's a different thing. So as I'm writing my book at the moment, what I'm finding is a lot of what I'm pulling out is stuff that's counterintuitive to what the world says gets us to success and keeps us there. And yeah, even a lot of the brain science, I was doing a communication workshop today, and I was saying, you know, our breath is super important, but we don't stop to breathe. Mm-hmm. And how can you be effective if you're not breathing properly? Your brain doesn't work properly. So yeah, I love, and yeah, I just love this whole topic, because where I see the whole adaptability, and you know, you and I have had a conversation about the word versatile is probably even a really more proactive version of adaptability, is when we do this well, we actually make it better for us. We make our, you know, from a health perspective, from a mental health perspective, makes us a better person to be around. And, you know, if we're in leadership, the impact we have is a way more positive impact than the one we do when we and you would have seen that in your story about that coach that, you know, was breaking people, and the one that was going like it's 2 weeks to the Olympic and they're, you know, a year out. That's because they're busy, and no judgment there. It's just they think that's going to work because that's what's worked before, but where we are now is different. And I don't think there's any question there. It was just sort of, you excited me with the discussion.
It is making me think of something, because I just really want to respectfully address, in the company of a good friend, the really strong forces, because we can say things like, oh, it's good to pay attention to ourselves, and we, by paying attention to ourselves, we make ourselves better leaders. But to really reflect on why that is so hard, and we have not been raised as a culture either. You know, you can hear from my accent, I'm not from around Australia, but the Australians and Americans are similar in this regard, that it's about what we do. It's not about who we are. You know, what we are is defined by who we are is defined by what we do. It's about, especially leaders, it's about helping others. And it's about leading. So leading is all about the other people. And so it is really counterintuitive. And I just want to underscore that word that you used. And I think whatever you can do, Danette, in your world to help leaders unpack and normalize why this is so difficult to do, because it sounds so freaking selfish. What do you mean I'm going to sit and just be? Much less do other kind of self-care things that would actually underpin my resilience so I can be a better leader. But we got to make taking care of ourselves first not sound like the ultimate act of selfishness, which would be if I'm going to make this gendered, women go there. Like, I've got to be taking care of it, my kids, everybody else. Men, on the other hand, their proclivity, and again, this is not an either or, would say, I don't want to appear weak. And so anything that you're asking me to do to take care of myself implies there's something wrong. You follow these two really, and does that resonate with you? Because I think I,
totally,
this is appalling, but I find that these are the things that make it hard for people to do more than pay lip service. And I don't want this to be a lip service public service announcement, but to really acknowledge there are powerful things happening that keep you and me, leaders, from fully embracing this space. And yet, given what I'm sure you, the leadership landscape, the amount of information coming through, the conflict, the isolation, the fractionalism, the uncertainty, if we don't get ourselves right, like it's almost a siren call. All right, I'll drop it there, but I just wanted to really kind of dig down into that point.
A bit. Oh, okay. Thank you. And, you know, if what we've done has got us to here, and, you know, COVID really showed that it's not going to take us much further. And, you know, and it's again why I loved your book, because it's like there is a better way, and that better way is often counterintuitive to what we're currently doing. And, you know, there's been many trends over many decades and years and centuries of things that we once thought were a great idea that we look back and we go, what were we thinking? And so I think now is the time where people are starting to go, I'm trying these things that I've done before, but it's just not doing it for me. And so, again, you know, I'd love for you to share a couple of ideas out of your book that really help people be able to move forward in a lovely, sustainable way without, you know, basically breaking people apart, etc.
All right. So, because I hear two questions, it's sort of how do I move forward, but also how do I move forward to take care of those around me? And so let's just in general, though, like there are a lot of things I could say in the physical realm about what we need to do to help ourselves, but that's not my jam per se. I'll as a psychologist, as a performance psychologist, I know just enough to be dangerous. You know, things about sleeping and about eating mindfully. But if we're talking about the realm of the brain and mind, you know, this is really around a very different approach to reality, in the sense that we don't like, first of all, humans are judgmental because that's just the nature of the beast. We judge everything all the time. And in certain ways, making quick judgments helps us make quick decisions. But in a complex world, sometimes we need to step away from judgment. But the other thing about judgment so often is that it doesn't help us move forward, in the sense that I can be pissed off and judgy about the fact that it's raining outside, or I can accept the reality of rain and put boots on and splash in puddles. And that's a very simplistic distinction, but how many times do we in business, do we in leadership get, and this is right out of the Buddhist doctrine, sort of Buddhist psychology is my thing here, but this, when we cling to things having to go a certain way, we often suffer. When we hate things, so it's the difference between clinging and aversion, as they might say in the Buddhist doctrine, but the ability to kind of ride the middle and be able to see both sides without getting too attached, it can sound disconnecting, and I think people in the West sort of knee-jerk away from it. But in fact, it gives us a more accurate view of what's happening without the reactivity, without the judgment, you know, and it forms a basis to make better decisions. So there's a whole, and this gets into the practice of meditation is one way to cultivate this mindset. And I will cheerfully say it's the mental equivalent to going to the gym, although I don't like to say the brain's a muscle, but it's this idea that we can actually train certain qualities of mind to make that probability of those kinds of cognitive and emotional outcomes more likely because we practice. And so the sitting down every day to be still has its own, dare I say, therapeutic benefits, but it's also a way of training the mind to be more accepting of reality as it is. So that's kind of the personal piece. When I think about the leadership piece, I talked about in my book, sort of this idea of purpose. And this is where I took a very slight and respectful divergence from Angela Duckworth's theory that she talks about grit being passion and perseverance knitted together to give us the tenacity for long held goals. In times of uncertainty, sometimes our passion can waver because the environment's so crazy. But often what we can supplant that with is a sense of values driven purpose. So when leaders, and we know who they are, who lead by, they know what their purpose is, they know the values they stand for, and they stay unwavering, they're generally, they have the kind of rudder that holds them through uncertainty in a way that passion isn't always there for us. So when we can spend the time, if we're not already there, to think about what is important to me, what do I represent, and am I living and communicating that to the people I lead? That's the stability they might need during uncertainty. And then I go on to argue that it's the idea that, especially in uncertainty, to be in service, you know, what is it that is needed, as opposed to always defaulting to, you know, being the stern decision or the decisive decision maker, may not be the answer if it's not serving the people I'm leading. So that's kind of a long answer to what's the personal and what the leadership qualities are that I feel assist us in times of uncertainty and change.
And what a great answer. And I hope people play this back a few times, because there's a number of really good insights there I learned a model which is a bit like a pendulum, and it talks about when we're high positive, you know, it's a bit like a drug high. When we're low negative, you know, our brain gets focused on the problem. But if we sit in that centered, quiet space, we become a little bit like that observer, but you make way better decisions because your brain's not running on chemicals that are basically not helping it to be really effective. And yeah, it's one of the reasons when I drive anywhere, I never have the radio or anything on, because I just like that quiet to settle my mind. And that's whether I'm going to do something or coming back from something. So awesome advice. Now, I've got one, because we sort of in this series are talking a little bit about failure and what it teaches us, and particularly, you know, around adaptability. Part of it is you're going to fail. So I'm curious, when you fail, you know, what helps you get out of that rut and move forward?
You mean me personally or anyone? Because I'm certainly as prone to failure as anybody else. And, you know, I don't think you disagree. And it's one of those life lessons that always say we learn way more from failures than we do from our successes, because our successes kind of, we can feel good and complacent, and we don't, it's actually less informative because we don't tend to look at it as much. We bask in it. But I think one of the first things that we have to do is, and this is again counterintuitive, because I come from sport where I'd have coaches be, you know, you need to hate failure. Failure's terrible. And, you know, I never liked failing. And when you come into it with that kind of reactive, judgmental mindset, you are setting yourself, dare I say, for failure, in the sense that it becomes a holy hell basket. And I could say things back in the day like, hey guys, failure isn't the F word. And I try to make it anthem, you know, like an anthem, but it's deeper than that, in the sense that, or I get more philosophical as I get older, I don't know which, but it's really seeing failure as part of a journey. And the way I look at it is, if you are trying to do anything that's hard, if you are trying to be a better version of yourself, if you're going into territory that's new, or in the case of an Olympic athlete who is on a trajectory of improvement to get them from 10th place in the last Olympics to the podium in this one, you are going to be treading on ground you've never tread before. And in so doing, if you don't predict and anticipate and know that you're going to learn from failure along the way, how do you get there? And so it's almost, you just want to be gentle and kind of predicting that it's going to happen rather than treating it like this horrible thing. And it that all sounds well and good, but the other piece of all of this is the kind of way in which we interact with ourselves as humans in this space, in the sense that I'm asking you to be okay with failure. But if you persist in cultivating kind of the inner critic who is like driving you, which I see so many high performers having, that monkey on their back, or, you know, that it's about this voice in my head that if I don't have it, I'll lose my edge. It's hard to live with an inner critic who is at the same time cheerful about failure. Because I will ask clients, okay, so tell me, this inner critic you're so proud of, do they like you? You know, and often you listen to the voice in your head that's kind of on you, and it doesn't sound like that. And the other question I'll ask is, and this isn't my work, Paul Gilbert is the founder of compassionate therapy, and so he brings these questions in, so I'm stealing from him. But the other question he has that I ask is, does your inner critic ever celebrate your successes? And I have yet to meet one. Anyone's inner critic who actually gets behind him on the podium and goes, woohoo. And so if we are subservient to that kind of voice in our head, it's going to be hard to also have room for a cheerful acceptance of failure. And I say cheerful in the sense it's not inevitable. I'm not like seeing myself as a loser, but that I can philosophically incorporate failure into me without breaking, and which to me then means we have some advanced work to do with the inner critic, because it's almost like a bifurcated world. And I, this is where I start talking about words like self-compassion. And where is the voice that comes in to say, well, that didn't go the way I thought it was going to go. That hurt. Whew, that's hard. But what's there to learn from this? Where is the inner critic? You idiot, I can't believe that happened. You can see that what I'm suggesting when we love failure needs some mindset massaging in order for it to actually work. And but it's self-compassion that goes along with that list of things that I think it's easy for people to say, oh yeah, I should be more self-compassionate, I'll do that tomorrow. And there's a lot of cultural conditioning, including the inner critic and this insistence on high performance, that says self-compassion is for tomorrow or for other people, but not for me. I'll drop the mic. You can see I'm, yeah.
Love it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm talking about self-compassion and compassion in the book. And, you know, my belief, it's really hard to be truly compassionate with others if you can't be self-compassionate, because you don't really know the impact of being self-compassionate and then the impact it can have on others when you are compassionate. So I really love that. And I loved your two voices. That could be a whole new show.
Well, of hand puppets, but the reality is we have many voices in our heads, and that's the people that are sane, much less the crazy people. But I love that point. And I think, though, it's so funny because I don't know that everybody would believe what you just said, that you need self-compassion before, because people will freely give to others. And when I talk about self-compassion, I often go to, what does compassion mean? When do you see it? How does it feel when you get it? How do you give it? And we have a whole conversation around that, because some people aren't even comfortable doing that, mind you. But nevertheless, most people get it. If a little kid falls down off his bike in the street and is crying, are you the first one to go over there and say, man up, get back on that bike, you jerk, come on, get going? Or do you actually like give him a little hug? You know, they can appreciate compassion in that sense. So we're more or less good at, we understand it. But then you turn it inside. And it's like, what? No, I'll lose, you know, and all the things we hear. And so I so often in my work as a performance psychologist or as a coach, will have to say things like, as I listen to somebody give me their inner dialogue about, you know, some failing of theirs, I'd say, if your best friend were sitting here having this exact same problem, what would you say? And it's that repeated going out to go in that is an unfortunate artifact of our society. And just to finish, there was a great quote about a story about a group of Western meditation teachers who went to see the Dalai Lama he wasn't in Tibet, he was in Nepal at this time, because they'd been they were talking to him about this idea of how pervasive this sense of self-recrimination and hatred was in the Western meditative world. And the Dalai Lama, it took him 10 minutes with his interpreter to even grasp what they were talking about. Because, you know, and it just spoke to the cultural conditioning of this, that this is not a human thing, but it's a Western culture thing. And he didn't believe it. He was like, are you telling me that not all beings see themselves as the most valuable, you know, some version of, I wish I had the quote in front of me, but it was this beautiful, like how he described how his culture views themselves. And he's getting this, no, that's not how it is here. And he like cried, you know, like, yeah, really. It was really powerful to the end. I guess I'll leave it there. You know, this is where we are.
That's such a beautiful story to demonstrate the difference. And yeah, our culture needs some work, a lot of work.
Well, it's all right. Compassionate way. This is the work I've been put on the planet to do. I am so sure.
Nice. Me too.
Yes. We need more than one of us. We're gonna
exactly. Oh, now, another question I'd love to ask is, yeah, throughout your life, there would have been times where you had a choice to adapt or not. What would have happened if, in a certain instance, you, and just pick one, you didn't adapt? What would have been the implications?
I mean, the story that's coming up for me is around an injury that I had and still have, where it was, now I'm looking at it in hindsight as being a lack of adaptability. In present moment time, it was a complete lack of misunderstanding about me and my relationship to me, which will make sense more shortly. But I had an injury, and as a former athlete and sports psychologist who spent a lot of time in elite sport, you'd think I'd know all the things you're supposed to be doing. At the same time, it was overlaid with what I now understood was undealt with anticipatory grief, because my dad was dying over in the United States and I wasn't able to go see him. I did, spoiler alert, I did get home through a lot of hook and crook and I did see him, but at the time I didn't think so. And I didn't realize, even as a psychologist, how that was impacting me. And I was taking it out on my body, which has led this injury now to be here almost 2 years later, in the sense that I was, like, talk about lack of adaptability, I was like using grit as a weapon. I was, you know, if I was gardening, I didn't care. I was like weeding like there was no tomorrow. I was working and I was being a terrible wife. I was taking it out emotionally. So a complete and utter lack of, and so I'm not sure if this fits, but it really was powerful for me because I received a talk about grief in my in email inbox from a meditation teacher. And I thought, maybe I should listen to this. And I sat down thinking, this will be good for me. This will help me adapt, maybe, I don't know. And within 5 minutes of that talk playing, I was crying so hard that I had one of those store-bought grocery store masks from L'Oreal on my face because it was going to be a little spa experience while I listened to this talk. Washed that whole damn thing off my face. And it was a lightning bolt moment around that even psychologists don't sometimes recognize what's right in front of them. So I didn't adapt, but I didn't even know. And also that as much love as I felt for my dad, and I was so scared I wasn't going to see him again, I was doing the opposite to me, which was like, you know, for somebody who had just written a book or was contemplating writing a book at that point and was somebody who was invested in self-compassion, I was so not applying it in such a profound way. And once I started to do that, and like, I couldn't love on myself enough, if that makes sense without sounding unutterably cheesy, but I think it's what saved me. Well, physically, even though I'm still dealing with the injury, and it gave me such compassion going into the time when I got to go home with my dad and be in the death experience with enough presence of mind to not be the grieving daughter, which I was, but to also be the supportive daughter for my dad. And it was such a beautiful thing to be there with him. I don't know if this, I may have just jammed a round peg into a square hole, but there's something there. Beautiful. About learning the hard way about adaptation.
You know, I often think when our emotions come, it is really hard to be self-aware to the point where you can go, okay, this is what's going on. And it is often an external prompt that you go, oh, if you're open to it. So thank you for sharing that story.
But if I can make a plug for meditation, sure. Because that's the kind of insight that comes easier. Now, who knows what I would have been like if I'd not been meditating, but I know that sometimes and many times, even in my case, it was in that situation, but there is a profound amount of wisdom we can gain, because it's not only about sitting with the shit show that's between our ears, but it's getting more aware and getting more clear about how our minds operate. And this idea, like I can now feel kind of a foreshadow, and I can go, huh, what's that? Now I don't do it every time, but I've gone from being slapped across the face by a life event to, and there, I, you know, if you think about an adaptable leader who can pick up on intuition faster and, you know, and be, at least be aware enough to go, because there is so much we are learning about neuroscience, the gut being the next brain, the gut reaction is a thing that we are attuned to other living beings, humans, before we even utter a word. There's so much to be picked up. If we can develop the ability to hear it, whether it's inside us or in how we read each other. And let's just say, oh, loyal listeners of Danette and I felt awesome vibes from Danette from the moment I saw her. So like, if you ever see Danette in person, you'll bask in her love of humanity, may I say. Back to you, Danette.
Oh, thank you. That's so beautiful.
Oh, it's, you know, we got to spread the love, man.
Absolutely. The world needs it. So absolutely. Now, I've got two more questions. And the first one is, if you had to go back to your 25-year-old self and give them some advice around adaptability, around grit, what might that advice be?
For me personally, it's interesting because I made probably one of the worst career choices ever, going from graduate school to a senior sports psychologist position at the U.S. Olympic Committee. And I say that in retrospect because my 25-year-old self was, yeah, I guess that was older, but you know, that when I think early in my career, I was at, so if I can have some artistic license with this, I was gritty because I was scared shitless. And what I'd want to be able to do is have enlarged my repertoire of coping from a base of understanding and of, I don't know how to say this in a way that's not going to sound trite, but like valuing, like be able to recognize the inherent value and what is here. But for, and maybe it was, you know, maybe I should have told my 25-year-old self to go get therapy earlier, because maybe that's what I needed. But I struggled for a long time gritting, because that was the only, you know, it was hard work. I'm going to do this. And yeah, I was a marathon runner. And why? Because when I went to graduate school, I was so convinced that I was going to flunk out, with no evidence whatsoever, but nevertheless, this is where you go, that I started to run in the morning just to clear my head, so to speak. But after a while, you know, the endorphins you get from exercise, you needed a bigger hit all the time. You know, had it been cocaine, I'd been snorting 10 lines, you know what I'm saying? But I kept running and running and running. And by the end of my first year of graduate school, I was running marathons because that was the next challenge that made me feel that much better. But you think about the ways in which I was, yeah, so it wasn't cocaine habit, it was an exercise habit, it wasn't bad. But getting back to my 25-year-old self, I would have liked to have had more awareness, more self-awareness, to be able to have broadened my horizons in that respect. And I guess that there's some profound things that I could say that I can't make a tie a knot around or a bow around, but I guess I'll leave it there and see what you come back with me about.
And yeah, I really do love that answer, because still there's a stigma about going and talking to people about what's going on in your head. Like, we'd quite happily go to a doctor and say, this is wrong with me. We won't go and seek, you know, help when this isn't working, our mind isn't working. And yet, if we want to be sustainable, adaptable, we need to recognize that we do need support, we do need help. So I actually think that's quite profound advice to give to your 25-year-old self. Because it gives you, you know, more tools in your box rather than just one, multiple. Yeah, yeah. I love it. Yeah. And that connection with another person who can support you with, because they see things you won't see because you're right in the midst of it. So, yeah, I love it. Love that answer.
And just thank you for doing my job for me, which is really advocating for the field of mental health. Because that is a subset of my business mantra, is making the unseen seen, because psychology and mental health are so hard to see, and that's part of why they're stigmatized. So what a beautiful, doing my job for me. Thank you very much. Next time, just interview yourself and say it's me, and we'll call it good.
I'm laughing so much I can't press the button on the mic. So I'd love, sort of, we're coming to the end, because I appreciate I've sort of been, it's the evening and I'm taking up your time, but is there anything else you'd like to share? If you're thinking about people who might be moving into leadership, who might be a leader, and they're really just looking at how do I adapt so that, and I like your idea of the service bit, because I totally believe that, you know, as leaders, we're there to serve. We're there to make the world a better place. So I'd love any last thoughts that you've got.
The thing that comes to mind for me, and I don't want it to sound cookie cutter, because but it's one of those truisms, I think, that can easily sound trite, but it's this idea, and I think it kind of comes out of my previous answer, is that I didn't trust who I was to be enough. And if we look at the really great leaders, and at least small L leaders, but it's people who were themselves, were first and foremost. So, you know, there's some line like, you might as well be yourself because all the other roles are taken, kind of. And but yet, there, it's a courageous act to, yeah, you can see by the way I'm dressed, I am no fashion plate. And it took me a while to get over my first corporate shots of me being the, you know, the kind of performance psychologist coach that I thought I should look like. And it's, so it's, but so it's at its core, who am I? What do I stand for? Because obviously values driven leadership is what we're talking about here, but I got to know. I want to know who I am. And maybe it is therapy, or if it's getting a good coach, if that's something that we're walking in as a leader not knowing how to do, I think getting someone to support us to find that voice, find and value that, because I see especially new leaders thinking I got to do it like the leader, my leader, or I've got to be somebody else, or got to be different than who I am, that you're doing the people you're leading a disservice, I think, because it's just harder to be somebody else. It's not, and getting back to the sustainable thing, if I'm always trying to put on a persona, God, that's exhausting. But I don't have an answer, a quick and easy podcast answer about how to get there, but just know, everyone, that, you know, you're going to be doing the best when you can be yourself, and do what you can to find what that is if you don't know. And I, you know, I'm not saying everybody knows, and but at least the values thing, to know what is it that I really think I stand for, but really stand for, not that somebody else has told me what I stand for. It might be, you know, so there's work that can be done there. Sorry, that's a long answer. I hope that kind of scratched the itch a bit.
That's a great answer. Because again, yeah, when we bring that self, we bring our unique perspective. And I think if we hide ourselves, it's hard to capture that from others as well, because we're signaling potentially that it's not safe to bring yourself to the workplace. And yet when we bring all of that wisdom from everyone in those different perspectives, that absolutely helps us be more adaptable, make way better decisions, etc. So I just think that was an awesome answer. So thank you.
Well, I appreciate it. I come at it from as a you know, executive organizational coach who sees people hampering themselves, and it, so it is not easy because we're conditioned sometimes to not even believe it's okay. And like I so many people will say, I can't be myself at work. Okay, so then who are you? You know, and that's a trite answer to that question, but it's really profound that I don't feel like I can be that, so therefore I'm working so hard to be somebody else. All right. Yes.
That was beautiful. That's such a great conversation. Can I say thank you so much? And I'm sure I'll have you back again.
Well, you know, we could have talked all night, I think. So I'm really, really appreciate the opportunity. And thanks for, yes, available at, well, at least online bookstores near you. And thank you so much, Danette. Have a great evening.
You're welcome.
So, Danette, we were talking about this idea of pausing, and it is interesting because both of us have experienced it, and maybe I've been guilty of it. You'd think the executive will say, the lack of time I have, I don't have time to think. And so the answer becomes, I need to put some thinking time into my calendar. When what I hear us talking about is more profound than that. Simple, this idea of pausing, but profound in the sense that even that our society, we're so conditioned, I guess, to think of anything we do as doing, that even to for an executive to have the time to think, thinking is doing, if you get my meaning. Whereas what you and I have been talking about is this idea of pausing to listen. And I guess you hearing me say that, what's the distinction that you hear me saying? Because I just want to play with this for a minute.
Yeah, I love it. So to pause to listen allows you to tap into your intuition. It allows you to tap into what's going on in the environment around you and to, I suspect, go way deeper than just going, I'm just going to book some time and think. That listening is listening to this, to our gut, to our heart, to the environment around us. And if we can just sit in that space, we can let things bubble up and actually hear. And that allows us to understand. What do you
Better.
think of that?
You brought it to levels that I had not considered, but beautiful, that sense of how what might come when you listen, what the levels, what the layers might be. And it is like the Buddhists would talk about observing, but listening to me is it's more accessible for me, I guess, that listening feels really receptive and not something we are trained to do in our culture. You and I were talking about before the podcast about the difference between what communication training is in the sense that it's 90% you learn how to speak. You know, it's public speaking classes, it's Toastmasters, you know, it's debate club, it's all about the overcoming the fear of speaking when, but if we look at how do we get trained to listen, it's in little kind of corny snippets like don't look at your watch, make eye contact, lean in, all of which are behaviors that make it look like we're listening, but doesn't really teach us that receptivity. And in fact, all those behaviors that you don't do them make you just slightly less shitty listeners. So I love that we unpack this because I think there's something really important here, if nothing else, that we encourage more listening to others, and that'll be in service. But imagine the radical act it takes to actually listen to ourselves, to our, as you say, intuitions, nagging feelings, gut, and see what happens. Like, wow, what, like we booked in that kind of time. I don't know what would happen. I guess we'll find out.
It'd be amazing.
Yeah,
That's all I've got to say. I'm in. Oh, I love it. And I'm glad we came back to this.
Wow, what a great conversation. We love the little extra bit on the end there. So for people that are wondering, the whole recording stopped and then I got to send a second file, which was the extra conversation, which you would have just heard at the end there. So an amazing conversation. You can tell you both had a lot of fun. Danette, what was your feelings on the conversation with KP and sort of talking about this rest and listening?
So you know what? It actually, the whole conversation demonstrated that because we paused at the end. So that's the rest. And then we both went, you know what, let's circle back to this bit of the conversation. And so then we just continued the conversation and we were able to go deep, and it was a really rich conversation and such an important point for adaptable leaders. So, yeah, it was just a great conversation.
Absolutely, absolutely. I know I took a lot of notes on this one as well. So just great. I hope everybody listening really took a lot away from it. And I think they would have loved the friendship that you two have. It was a real blast to listen to. As always, we've got listener-submitted questions that are sort of to do around the theme. And, of course, our theme was how that listening and rest creates Olympic-level performance. And today we've got a question from Isidore. So Isidore asks, why do I always feel like falling asleep when I'm on a course in a classroom-type scenario? I'm well-rested and listening to the person talking. It's extremely annoying, and I've had it since school.
So a couple of different things. I'd go back to the one I often use in the podcast advice is check with your medical professional that you are actually getting good sleep. And obviously people use, you know, watches and stuff to monitor their sleep because some people have, you know, undiagnosed things around their sleep. And without good sleep, fundamentally everything else is harder. So I definitely get that checked out first. The other thing is, you know, look at those environments. So are they environments where you know, even before school, were able to learn well in? So some people don't learn particularly well listening to others. So it may also be something that it's not necessarily your preference on how you take in information. So there might be better ways, maybe even getting it transcribed and reading it could be more helpful. The big bit about, I think, for learning is setting your intention. So what am I hoping to get out of this? You know, do that pause or rest as KP talked about is actually what is it I'm hoping to get out of this? So you're not trying to listen for everything because you may know a lot of the stuff already. You're listening for the stuff that you don't know and really trying to capture that. And you might be a person who needs movement. So, you know, having something where you can doodle and write out those main points, or maybe draw them if you're a bit more artistically created, or, you know, maybe it's recording those main points. That could help you. But I'd absolutely go and find out first what's going on with your sleep and what's causing you to nod off in the classroom, etc., because I think that's the first thing before you move forward.
Great. And I actually have a little recommendation off of that. There's an app you can download called Otter, like the animal.
Yes.
And it can record what you're saying and transcribe it. So if you are someone that would prefer a transcription, you just put that down and it works really, really well. So I highly recommend that. And I think you get like 250 minutes free. So if you're just watching a lecture, you just pop that on and then it'll give you a full transcript afterwards.
Nice.
All right. Well, Danette, any final thoughts on the conversation with KP or how to use rest and listening to sort of get to an Olympic level?
And obviously you can hear the girls in the background. Oh, they've just stopped. So, you know, to be a sustainable, adaptable leader, you need to rest. Like, there's no two ways about it. And that means getting good night's sleeps, taking breaks during the day, and also booking your holiday so that you're having regular breaks, because that's where your brain does the hard work. And I think a key skill of an adaptable leader is first to learn to listen to themselves, because you need to understand yourself, you need to get self-aware, and then learning to listen to others, because great adaptability includes collaboration And that means you need to be able to hear all voices and the different perspectives to come up with, you know, different experiments that you can try to move the organization forward. You know, working on hard, complex problems with different perspectives just makes it so much better. This was such a great podcast. Totally enjoyed it. Hope you do too. Thanks, cheers.
That's all right. And everybody, thanks for sharing and listening. And as always, have a magical week.